live, guys. Just a minute. Going live in just a minute. Just getting some stuff settled. We're getting there. It's coming together. The studio is coming together. Don't you worry. Going live. Good morning and welcome to episode 3 of the Rabbit Hole Power Hour. Affectionately known as RHPH, this is my show. It's where I go online, find some interesting stories, share it with my friends, and create a little archive. If you're joining me, I appreciate it. I'll let you know what kind of stories we're getting into. Today I got 4 short stories and 1 longer story. So today it's going to go, first up, we're going to Fox News for a story called Pennsylvania Man Accused of Rigging Tripwire in Home to Kill Wife. I'm very fortunate, says the wife. After that, we got Inside the 18th Century Compendium of Demonology and Magic, an Illustrated Guide to Hell. That's only 2 pages. Then I got a quick blurb from a guy named Howard Massicote about Nikola Tesla. After that, I got a guy named Alan Greenfield with a story coming from Phantoms and Monsters. It's called Black-Eyed Kids Standing Along Rural North Florida Road, Frightening Witnesses. And that is, I think, only about 2 pages. And then the finale, this is a 23 to 29 minute read. It's from ancient.eu, and it's called Lost Civilizations of Anatolia, Göbekli Tepe. So let's get into it. First, we go to our mainstream friends over at Fox News. Yes, Mr. Murdoch. What do you have for us today? A Pennsylvania man has been arrested after state police say he plotted to kill his wife over the weekend by rigging a tripwire at the top of a flight of stairs to the basement. William Joseph Dankschreiter, Jr., 60 years old of Derry Township, was being held on a $500,000 bond after his arrest on an attempted murder charge. Pennsylvania State Police said the intended target was his wife. Laura Dankschreiter, 59, says, "I'm a mess. You don't plan on your husband of 27 years trying to kill you." She said she actually tripped over the wire, but didn't fall. "I'm very fortunate," she said. "I went backward instead of forward." She added, "If I went forward, I probably wouldn't be here today." Police said metal eye hooks secured a fishing line about 3 inches above the carpet, right at the door that led to the basement of the couple's home. kind of mind-boggling someone would do something so deviant to try and hurt someone, said Trooper Steve Lamani while talking to WPXI-TV. He goes on to say, I don't know how long he was thinking this through, but you could definitely see there was line tied across. There was nothing accidental about this. Laura called police to the home Saturday after her near fall. William was arrested when he drove up as she was speaking to troopers. Wow, that is pretty intense. I can't imagine some shit like that going down. That's some real evil right there. Probably over money, too. Anyway, moving on. This is why it's a rabbit hole. We just keep going. We just read different things. And who knows? You might find something you like, or it could just be a big waste of your time. Inside, the 18th Century Compendium of Demonology and Magic, an Illustrated Guide to Hell. Whether it's ghastly demons or grisly execution scenes, this occultist tome and witchcraft manual remains as haunting today as it was in 1775. By Steve McCamley. Hybrid demons, cabalistic symbols, dancing skeletons, and dark spells of magic. These are only some of the occult elements that fill the pages of the mysterious 18th century manuscript entitled Compendium of Demonology and Magic. Though we may never know who created the book and why, there's one thing we do know for certain. This book is not for the faint of heart. In 1775, someone, likely a worshiper of the occult, made it their business to compile a collection of astonishingly detailed illustrations of demons and magical rituals into one book. That book is now known as the Compendium of Demonology and Magic. Its original title was actually Compendium Rericium. Compendium Rerissimum Totius Artis Magicae Systematiste Per Celeberimus Artis Hujus Magistros, which roughly translates to a rare summary of the entire magical art by the most famous masters of this art. Written in a mixture of German and Latin, the 18th century demonic guide opens with an eerie page adorned by skeletons and a warning that reads, Noli me tangir, meaning do not touch me. Its pages contain remarkably vivid drawings depicting over 30 kinds of beastly creatures from hell, as shown in the gallery above. Which, of course, you guys can't see. Evidence of the occult has been found throughout history in different parts of the world. The illustrations appear to be watercolor and are mostly drawn on white, brown, and gray-green paper. The figures themselves are extremely dark and disturbing in nature, but nonetheless fascinating to look at. Among the bizarre demons, you'll find a giant red figure with black wings, large eyes, and snakes jutting out from its forehead. It's caught mid-spring, coming out of the ground with smoke and fire as it feeds on a bloody meal of what appear to be human limbs. Another graphic demon depicted among the book's artwork is a creature so grotesque and mismatched in its anatomy that it resembles a Frankenstein experiment from hell. This demon has fire jutting out of its ears, large fangs, and a misshapen abdomen covered in spots and hooved feet. But the most disturbing thing about this figure is what it is doing, birthing small dragon-like creatures. In addition to the demonic drawings, the author also drew what appear to be visual instructions that may be used as a reference in performing the mystic rituals written in the book. Some of these scenes could be related to necromancy, which is the act of communicating with the dead to read and possibly control the future. There are also a few pages of Kabbalistic symbols. The book's origins are obscure, and its author remains unknown. But the misdated year 1057 written on its cover suggests that whoever created the compendium was likely trying to pass it off as an ancient manuscript of sorts. The physical book is under the custody of the Wellcome Library in London, United Kingdom. The compendium, though entirely gripping in its vivid illustrations of satanic creatures, is not the only manuscript relating to witchcraft from earlier centuries. In the 16th century, a Dutch doctor turned occult practitioner named Johan Weyer published Pseudo-Monarchia Demonum, known by its English title as The False Hierarchy of Demons. Which was a similar compendium written in Latin, its pages contained the names of 69 demons. According to Weyer himself, he created the mystic book based on an earlier text about spirits and demons, written by another practitioner, though it's unclear what work he was referring to. Weyer's Pseudo-Monarchia Demonum, which was not his first work on demonology, was declared by Sigmund Freud as one of the 10 most significant books of all time. Even older still is the Codex Gigas, the largest medieval manuscript in the world, measuring at a whopping 36 inches tall, 20 inches wide, and nearly 9 inches thick. Historians believe it likely took over 20 years to complete the book. The most striking is perhaps the large demonic illustration that inexplicably sits in the middle of the massive book. Due to its old age and the effects of war, the true origin of the Codex Gigas has been lost to history, but legend has it that the entire manuscript was written in a fortnight by a monk named Herman the Recluse, who was nearly buried alive for breaking his vows. To win back his freedom, the monk obliged to write a book containing all the world's knowledge overnight. Ironically, the monk summoned the devil to help him with a Herculean task in exchange for his soul, which is how the odd drawing inside the book allegedly came to be. The historic relic, now called the Devil's Bible, sits on display at the National Library of Sweden in Stockholm. Unfortunately, the real stories behind some of these curious manuscripts will forever remain untold. This article was originally created for All That Interesting and is published here under Creative Commons. All right, that was pretty cool. An 18th century compendium. You don't see that every day. Moving on, I got this little quip from Howard Massicotte, speaking about Nikola Tesla. Here's his quote. "Earth is not a planet, not a thing with edges. The Earth is a realm, better described as a system environment, with the sun and moon maintaining the firmament electrically. The sun and moon are two poles to a massive plasma electromagnet called the firmament. A rotor, Nikola Tesla called it. And he called the earth the stator on his induction motor. He called the sun and moon the magnet. We have alternating current thanks to Nikola Tesla, and his induction motor he copied looking at the sky and nature. Biomimicry, electric mimicry, all great inventors mimic Mother Earth and nature. An induction motor harnesses alternating current, electricity. It is a very simple invention. Basically, it's a rotor, a stator, and a magnet. Tesla came up with it by seeing that we live in one. He said so much. He said we live in a Tesla coil, an induction motor. The rotor is the sky, the stator is the earth, and the sun and the moon is the magnet. Simple, stupid. That comes from Howard Massicotte. And next, we're going to a guy named Alan Greenfield from MeWe. The story is called Black-Eyed Kids Standing Along Rural North Florida Road, Frightening Witnesses. A teen boy and his mother are driving early in the morning to school when they notice three black-eyed kids in strange school uniforms standing at the entrance to their neighborhood. The following account was forwarded to me. This happened back in high school, during my junior year. I lived near Jasper in North Florida at the time. I missed the bus and I didn't have a car, so my mom had to drive me to school. The main road was a long rural stretch that only had one equally tiny other neighborhood and a few houses here and there. It was 6 a.m. or something and still dark outside, and it was cold. As we're pulling out of our neighborhood, my mom and I both saw these three children in blue and white private school uniforms standing side by side, shoulder to shoulder at the entrance of the neighborhood on the sidewalk. It was either two girls and one boy or two boys and one girl. I don't remember the ratio, but the girl wore blue and white skirt or dress outfit, and the boy wore a blue short sleeve shirt with khaki shorts. This was weird for a few reasons. One, it was 40 degrees outside. They looked like they were dressed for the summer, and they didn't even wear coats or anything. Secondly, there were two schools in the area, but not a private school until the next town over, and blue and white weren't the school uniform's colors. Third, what young kids just stand there in a single file line, not doing anything but standing? No joshing around, no nothing? Yeah, right. Lastly, this wasn't where the bus stop was. It was a few blocks down. Just a sprinkle of extra creepy on top for shits and giggles. There wasn't any streetlights. They were just standing in the dark. Not doing jack except being creepy as hell, I guess. They were on the corner on the right, closest to the passenger side, where I was obviously sitting. And of course, we were turning right. As we got closer, I thought at first they didn't have faces, but it was just too shadowy and dark out. And the headlights only shone under their shoulders, which is how I can remember the outfits so vividly. Then we got closer and I was relieved to see they had faces, but then got completely freaked out all over again when I saw their eyes were all black. Like supernatural Sam and Dean fighting demons, all black. My mom saw it before I did, and she put the pedal to the metal and hightailed it out of there. I remember trying to look back and see them, but I couldn't since it was too dark. My mom didn't go back home until the sun rose, and it was bright enough to not be scared. Of course, nobody believed me at school, and my siblings thought we were full of it, but we know what we saw. We never saw them again after that, though. I thought they were ghosts, but a few months after that, I heard about black-eyed children on YouTube and made the connection. We moved shortly after that due to unrelated reasons. This was 2 years ago, and I had blissfully forgotten about it until my mom said, "Hey, remember when?" I hope my irrational anxieties and fear around children that are small enough for me to punt across a soccer field is amusing, at least. And that was Alan Greenfield from MeWe. And the final story, the big one. This is called Lost Civilizations of Anatolia, Göbekli Tepe, from ancient.eu. Sorry about that. Let me rewind. I normally have a tradition on this stream. After the first story, I have some quality Iranian tobacco. and I blew through four stories and forgot all about it. So I'm going to do that right now. So give me just a quick second. I'm still with you guys. If you're with me and you got something smokable, spark it up. All right. That is much better. Sometimes I have to calm down with a little bit of tobacco. And now, the final story of the day, Lost Civilizations of Anatolia, Göbekli Tepe. Göbekli Tepe is the world's oldest example of monumental architecture, a temple built at the end of the last ice age, 12,000 years ago. It was discovered in 1995 CE, when, just a short distance from the city of Sanliurfa in southeast Turkey, a Kurdish shepherd noticed a number of large embedded stones, stones which had clearly been worked, and which turned out to be the most astonishing discovery by Tiamen Simit. Anatolia is described variously as a melting pot of civilizations and cultures, a bridge between Asia and Europe, a fusion of East and West, and many other familiar and overused descriptions. All now rather pedestrian, but accurate nonetheless. It is certainly a fact that Anatolia has the unnerving habit of turning up lost civilizations and vanished cultures. It is unnerving for two reasons. In the modern age, we have covered so much ground, physically and intellectually, that we think we should know everything by now. And it is unnerving because, intrinsically, an entire civilization is a hard thing to lose, especially in a place that is supposed to be a bridge and has been tramped across by so many peoples since the very dawn of civilization itself. But Anatolia still does it. The story of Schliemann's discovery of Troy in 1870 and 1871 CE had the benefit in a Western culture and in the Western literary canon of being very well known, and its discovery was a revelation and a cause for great popular wonder and excitement. The discovery and excavation of Bagaskali was another revelation, was another revelatory event, if less celebrated by the general public. After all, the Hittites were just bit players in a biblical narrative, not wholly unfamiliar, but more of a footnote. However, academics and scholars were aware of the fact that there was a significant missing component to ancient Near Eastern history, a lacuna just hinted at by tantalizing discoveries made in the late 19th century CE. The discovery and the excavation of the Hittite capital, locked away in its central Anatolian mountain vastness in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, CE filled in a huge gap, a gap reduced even further by the translation of the Hittite language by the Czech linguist Hrazny in 1915 CE, and the wealth of documentary evidence that had been turned up during excavations at the Royal Library in Hattusa, and which could now be read. However, the discovery of Göbekli Tepe was just a massive shock. Going back to the end of the last ice age and first constructed around 10,000 BCE, the site is known as Göbekli Tepe, meaning Potbelly Hill, or the hill near the navel. And what has emerged since that day in 1995 CE is nothing short of extraordinary. a site of significant size containing first circular enclosures and then rectangular rooms dominated by remarkable carved and decorated monoliths. So far, over 25 of these enclosures have been identified, and two of the earlier ones have now been fully excavated down to floor level, revealing an unknown and unimagined culture that turned the archaeological world on its head. The most startling thing about this site is its great age. Going back to the end of the last ice age and first constructed around 10,000 BCE, in Kurdish, they call it Giri Navoke, which has the same meaning as all the other names it has. The monument comes to us from the distant past and from a time when, according to the existing historical narrative, it simply should not have been there. This is monumental architecture on a grand scale, preserved to an extraordinary degree. But silent. While we can describe the site in minute detail and study its physical attributes with all the tools of modern science, we can only speculate as to the motives of the builders or the culture of the people. All of this was accomplished 6,000 years or more before the invention of writing. And there is an additional riddle within this enigmatic and haunting place. The great enclosures, after being used for hundreds of years, were simply buried. The rest of the site continued to be used with smaller, more modest structures built on the mound created by the burial of the original monuments. And then, after a period of use as a site for gathering and a place of ritual that may have lasted for 2,500 years, the place was simply abandoned. Its initial construction period is referred to as Pre-Pottery Neolithic A, or PPNA, meaning it comes from a period that predates the invention of pottery vessels, and it also dates pre-writing. Göbekli Tepe exists in a part of human history that is unimaginably distant at the end of the last ice age. Most importantly, this is in all likelihood a religious or cult site, not a settlement site. There is no evidence of anyone having lived here, although remnants of food preparation demonstrate occupation at certain times. The construction was a huge effort, and Professor Schmidt, the German archaeologist who excavated the site, believed that hundreds of people came from far and wide for specific cultural or religious rituals over an extended period of time, and then went back to their territories, or hunting grounds, and their daily lives. The site was only used for very important events, and while no burial evidence has been found, Professor Schmidt said these could be behind the walls. He says, we must be patient to answer these questions and only excavate what we need. How does one give the site a cultural and historical context? With no pottery and no writing, there can be no indication of how these ancient people perceived themselves. The archaeological team had to compare archaeological sites, taking materials from Göbekli Tepe and other sites which are related by archaeology, and which can be carbon dated to compare the findings. The practice of site burial also gives an indication of age, since the material used to backfill the main enclosure contains significant quantities of animal material, which can be carbon dated. A defining characteristic of Göbekli Tepe are the monumental T-shaped stones that are often arranged in a circle. Since the early 1990s CE, a number of sites across southeastern Turkey, essentially the northern arc of the Fertile Crescent, have emerged which have these anthropomorphic T-shaped monoliths. They have also been found in other parts of the Sanliurfa region and in the center of the Sanliurfa itself. It would seem that a number of the T-shaped stones, which stand within the stone-walled circles, are clearly representative of human figures, and a number of them possess arms, clothing, and adornment, but significantly, they have no facial features. The other contemporary sites around the region, which include gatherings of these anthropomorphic T-shaped pillars, are all a part of what is probably of mixed domestic and working environments, making what is the ritual sphere a part of daily life. Göbekli Tepe was set apart from any domestic site and would have taken some effort, not just to build, but also to visit. It is also set apart, especially in its early phase, by the sheer size and monumentality of the T-shaped pillars. This is especially true of the oldest phase of construction and use, where most of the pillars have sophisticated carved decoration and reliefs. Some of them stand up to 5.5 meters tall and weigh as much as 20 tons. The quarry that produced the stones is just a few hundred meters away, where one can still see some pillars. Partially excavated, but remaining in situ, and attached to the bedrock, but abandoned because of flaws. The site chronology can be broken down into three levels, which represent the main phases of construction and use, one being the most recent and three being the most ancient, and therefore the deepest level. Layer 3 is also the most sophisticated level at Göbekli Tepe, a fact which poses some interesting questions. This is a site that, in terms of artistic endeavor, construction, and concept, seems to go backwards rather than progressing with the passage of time. Level 2 is much more basic. While level 1 represents the thousands of years of abandonment, or much later, agricultural use, factors featuring in these changes may include changing social structures, economy and religious practice, and so on. Level 1 still produces many relevant finds, but these would have been relocated by erosion and farming. While the overall size of Göbekli Tepe site is quite considerable, the ancient core currently being excavated is of a more modest size and is represented by 4 enclosures identified by lettering, A through D, so designated by the order of their discovery. In level 3, the oldest levels, each enclosure is characterized by different thematic components and artistic representations. And the early groups of enclosures are roughly circular in shape. The first area to be excavated was enclosure A, which is known as the snake enclosure, because depictions of snakes dominate the carvings on the T-pillars. These are, in some places, extremely intricate, including one on pillar number 1, which depicts a group of tightly packed snakes contained in what appears to be a net or wicker basket, set above a wild sheep or ram. The leading edge of the steel has 3 carved snakes moving downwards, and 1 snake moving up. All the snakes carved at Göbekli Tepe are carved in a downward motion, except for this single example. The snakes are shown as short, thick creatures with broad, flattened heads, typical of snakes which inhabit the Urfa region today, including the common Levantine viper. It is interesting to note that this snake holds a very powerful position in the mythology of Anatolia, even today. Along with the snake, images of the fox are a consistent feature, and possibly the fox has some totemic value for important members of this culture. Although, unlike the snake, the fox doesn't appear to have survived with a significant folkloric role in the wider region today. Another pillar depicts a grouping of an auroch, a very large and now extinct bovine, a fox, and a crane. positioned one above the other in what may represent a narrative of some description. This is a thought-provoking narrative because the depiction of the crane is anatomically incorrect if the carver was depicting what he actually saw in the wild. As the knees of the crane articulate backwards in the same fashion that a human knee does. Any member of a hunting and gathering society will know from an early age that a bird's knee articulates forward. And with a long-legged bird such as a crane, this forward movement is very marked indeed. What in fact may be depicted here is a human dressed as a crane. Could this be a hunting scene, or possibly a depiction of a dance to invoke the attributes of the creatures being depicted? This anatomical puzzle is repeated elsewhere. The central pillars in enclosure A do not have the anatomical features such as arms that we see on other pillars at this site and elsewhere, but the animal depictions are particularly vivid. Nor do the pillars have any obvious structural purpose. Enclosure B is in the shape of a rough oval measuring about 10 to 15 meters and about 9 meters east to west. Okay, that was 10 to 15 north to south and 9 meters east to west. And it has a constructed terrazzo floor. This enclosure is called the Fox Pillars Building because the image of the fox predominates. The two central pillars each have a life-size fox carved on them, both facing inwards and given their posture in mid-leap. But interestingly, on one of the stones, the fox appears to be pouncing upon a small rodent-like creature that was etched into the pillar at a later date. Enclosure C is dominated by superb renderings of wild boar and birds. Curiously, snakes are completely absent from this enclosure and appear to have been replaced in terms of use and positioning by images of the boar. Along with the two central pillars, there are 11 in the inner circle, and so far, 8 in the outer circle. Several may have been removed prior to the site's burial. At some point after the burial of enclosure C, a large pit was dug in the central area of the enclosure, and both standing central stones were smashed into several pieces. This construction is a little different in that the enclosure is built as a series of up to 3 concentric circles. One could even describe it as a sort of spiral. At some point after the burial of enclosure C, possibly post-Neolithic, a large 10-meter diameter pit was dug in the central area of the enclosure, and both standing stones were smashed into several pieces. It is impossible to know the circumstances of this episode of iconoclastic vandalism, and it is repeated elsewhere at Göbekli Tepe. It has been determined that the violence of this attack was considerable because the eastern pillar was cracked apart by an intense fire. We do, of course, have numerous examples in our own more recent history to refer to of religious change driving destructive forces. The violence directed by English Puritans against the decorative elements in England's great medieval cathedrals and churches, right down to the destruction of the Buddhas of Bamiyan by Taliban iconoclasts in Afghanistan, and the cultural atrocities carried out by ISIL, not sure what that is, are merely 3 examples of many. The reconstruction of the Western Pillar from fragments of the original is adorned with a life-sized fox relief on the inward face in mid-leap southwards, southward towards the entrance. The eastern pillar, most of which is missing, was adorned with a bull on its inward face. It is fortunate that the violence was only directed at the central pillars, because around the perimeter wall of enclosure C are to be found some of the highest quality stonework at Göbekli Tepe, including an extraordinary high relief, or what's known as Pillar 27, of a freestanding feline above a wild boar. The enclosure is built onto the plateau's surface on the natural bedrock. Enclosure D is referred to as the Stone Age Zoo because of the wide variety of animal imagery. The dominating feature of this enclosure is the massive pair of central T-shaped steel. I don't know if that's steel or stele, S-T-E-L-E. Clearly intended to represent human figures and monumental in scope. They face south and are set on an ornamental pedestal, one of which is decorated with what appear to be ducks, and they stand at an impressive height of 5.5 meters. Just a second. Sorry about that. I had to do some adjustments here in the studio. Both standing pillars have arms clasped at the belly, just above a decorated belt and a fox pelt loincloth, with the tail hanging down at the front. The pillar standing eastwards has a life-sized fox in the crook of its right arm leaping toward the south, but significantly, there are no facial features. Apart from the belt and loincloth, both figures have what could be described as neck adornments, which are clearly symbolic. This enclosure also has, as one of its perimeter stones, the most discussed, and possibly the most disturbing set of Göbekli Tepe images of all. This is pillar number 43, the Vulture Stone. The bizarre images on this pillar include, on the left-hand side, a vulture holding an orb or egg in an outstretched wing. Lower down, there is a scorpion, and the imagery is further complicated by the depiction of a headless, ichthyophallic man. The enclosure is also built on natural bedrock, which was leveled and smoothed to construct the central pillars, pedestals, and floor. There is one further enclosure, enclosure E, which is about 100 meters east and slightly south of this grouping of enclosures. Nothing remains except the floor plan and foundation sockets for the central pillars. The floor is carved directly from the bedrock. Just adjacent to the enclosure, there are some carved depressions, which may be small cisterns carved from the rock. There are other larger examples found along the ridge of Göbekli Tepe. There are no springs in the vicinity, so water supply would have been a problem. There is also a grouping of cup-like depressions carved into the rock, which are replicated at other Neolithic sites in the region. But there are no real theories as to what they may have been for. Destruction and reuse. All the enclosures at level 3 were filled in prior to the constructions on level 2. It is unclear why this was done, but there seems to be a conscious decommissioning of the structures at level 3. Because some pillars were damaged or moved in an organized and controlled manner, while some pillars seem to have been removed entirely. Small artifacts remained, and statues were left in situ but toppled. Some of the tops of the pillars in enclosure C are completely broken off. The tops of the intact central pillars have carved, cup-like depressions. It appears that when the level 3 structures were buried, just the tops remained above ground, and these cup-like depressions were carved once burial was complete. It would seem that Level 3, original construction around 9500 BCE, was buried in phases after hundreds of years of use. Once again, the purpose of this is speculative, but receptacles for votive offerings or candles are a reasonable suggestion. With the construction and use on Level 2, people were clearly using the site and would have been aware of the buried enclosures, the tops of which were protruding just above the surface, evidence of the convocation of standing stones just below. It is also reasonable to conclude that, although buried, the ancient enclosures still played a role of sorts in the ritual life of the people who continued to build and gather here. One cannot be absolutely precise, but it would seem that Level 3, original construction around 9500 BCE, was buried in phases after hundreds of years of use. The content of the material used to fill the enclosures is a huge source of hard data. The composition of the infill material is simply refuse produced by hunting, food preparation, and consumption, mixed in with infill material which included the residue of construction, stoneworking, thousands of flint tools, and the remnants of tool manufacture. The spoil tells us some important things about these people. The tools themselves. In the absence of the archaeologist's basic dating tool, pottery can be used to produce a broad cultural and chronological context in which data from other sites can be used to produce rough dates. Just a second. Hang with me for just a second. Pottery can be used to produce a broad cultural and chronological context in which data from other sites can be used to produce rough dates. Level 2 is a different environment, both conceptually and artistically. It is evident that the society and the culture are undergoing an important series of changes, while important cultural markers remain. The enclosure spaces are far smaller and much more modest, while decorations are simpler and are executed with less skill. They are also far more numerous and are constructed almost in a jumble of competing floor plans, on top of Level 3 and sometimes cutting into Level 3. They are certainly considerably less ambitiously monumental than before. This is possibly a society that has exhausted itself both economically and spiritually with Level 3. It may be evidence of a transitional period before the abandonment of Göbekli Tepe and the evolution of more settled societies, such as the one at Çatalhöyük in the Konya Plain, which is dated from 7500 BCE. However, speculation aside, the most elaborate of these now more modest rectangular enclosures is the so-called Lion Building. Identified by the carving on one of its principal stones, while probably still a purely cult or religious site with no evidence of domesticity, the enclosures are small and in many respects resemble the domestic buildings in other places, such as Nivali Kore, and it could be that economic and cultural changes are reflected in construction patterns here. Over the 2013-2014 CE season, archaeologists were uncovering another enclosure, Enclosure H, about 250 miles away from the original Level 3, and on the other side of the hill towards the northwest. This is referred to as the Northwest Depression, and at first glance, looks almost to mirror the original existing excavation. Also built on Level 3, this enclosure possesses good-sized central steel set in an oval-shaped structure. As with Enclosure C, representations of wild boar seem preeminent. The enclosure, like all others, was buried after its useful life. However, somebody, as with Enclosure C, took the time and effort to excavate a pit, locate the central standing stones, and destroy one. The other one still awaits investigation. Why? Clearly what connects Enclosure C and H, and possibly enclosures yet to be discovered, are design. All are oval and with an accessing staircase. The level, age, and artwork also, but above all, these two enclosures are connected by identical acts of desecration carried out long after the enclosures were buried. These acts of desecration would suggest a number of possible scenarios, none of which necessarily exclude the others. Clearly, the act of burying enclosures on Level 3 and the evolution of the structural design changes seen on Level 2 would indicate a conclusion of a life cycle for these structures, and a change of political and economic, although not cultural or religious, fundamentals. The question of deliberate, targeted, and heavy destruction in enclosures, but continued site use suggests a continuity of belief for a considerable period of time, but with major changes in the power dynamics of the society represented at and by this extraordinary site. The origins of Göbekli Tepe. There are many theories contributed by non-academic and alternative writers of popular books about the origins of Göbekli Tepe and its builders, most of which are understandably concerned with the amazing and very photogenic remains on Level 3. They range from an ancient civilization of amazing complexity via vaguely biblical references to, quite literally, the stars. In terms of stellar alignments, the archaeological team, being careful people who rely on slowly accumulated and assessed evidence, will not rule this out, but do gently point out that there is no evidence of alignment with any star or constellation. The site is clearly oriented, but the Level 3 enclosures are oriented southwards and down the plain of Haran, from where the people might have approached, and not in relation to the night sky or any apparent astronomical feature. Looking at the topography of the area, this would seem reasonable. Even today, the most logical approach is from the south. It is possible that this southern alignment faces a processional approach. It is true that the act of processing features strongly in the ritual lives of ancient peoples, evidenced by ancient sites such as the proposed transition between Woodhenge and Stonehenge, or the menagerie etched into the Nazca Plains right up to modern times, with religious rites such as the Stations of the Cross, or state ceremonies such as the state opening of Parliament in the United Kingdom. Level 2 enclosures display no particular alignment pattern. After the abandonment of Level 2, we see nothing happening at Göbekli Tepe other than the slow evolution of Level 1, which represents the establishment of a rugged agricultural and semi-nomadic life across the environment we see today. With minor contributions during the Roman, Byzantine, and Islamic periods, and which hid the drama of the numerous and silent convocations of monolithic beings just below the surface. The name Göbekli Tepe, or Hill of the Navel, could well be a faint cultural echo to those very distant times. It is certainly true that many Neolithic cultures were characterized by a symbolic connection to the earth via a magical navel or umbilical cord. Even today, this is a respected and venerated location to which the adorned wishing tree at the top of the mound attests. We can only speculate as to the precise nature of the seminal changes that went on during this ancient time, and which are tantalizingly represented in this amazing place. But to paraphrase a popular warning we hear today in our own rapidly evolving culture, please speculate responsibly. This article has been reviewed for accuracy, reliability, and adherence to academic standards prior to publication. And this was The Lost Civilizations of Anatolia at Göbekli Tepe from ancient.eu. And that, my friends, is my show for the day. That's all I have. I'm going to wrap it up. So I thank you all for joining me. It's been fun. I'll catch you next time. And talk to you later. And have a great day. Alright, if there's anyone on Podbean, I'm still here. I'm still here for Podbean. Alright, what do we have here? I want to give a big shout out to my first follower of Podbean, Big Chief Thunderlungs. He co-hosts Raccoon 6 with co-hosts Raccoon 6 and Chris Wilson. He discusses all. Oh, I see. All right, I'm gonna give you a follow back. There we go. That's cool. All right, guys. Well, I thank you for joining me for this. Give me a follow, and I'll give you a shout-out on my show. Until then, I'll talk to you later. Have a great day.